Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu. And by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet. Insured by NCUA.
Its current state for Tuesday, March 26, 2013. I'm Mark Bayshore. We're glad you're here. Lansing City Council President Carol Wood coming up on the program in just a little while for her response to Mayor Virge Bernero's new budget. We found out that the city is contending with only a $5 million budget deficit, which sounds a whole lot more manageable than a $9 million budget deficit. But I'm not sure anybody found out about that until last night. So we'll ask Carol about that and about the mayor's proposal that would really impact Board of Water and Light customers here in Lansing. But that is all coming up right around 9:30. A name already associated with government and politics here in Ingham County is about to become more familiar. East Lansing's Curtis Hertel Jr. has announced he wants to be the 23rd District's next state senator. The 35-year-old Democrat currently serves as the County Register of Deeds, where he's been an advocate for quite a few foreclosed county residents. And he's generally, I think it's safe to say, he's been a thorn in the side of the banking and mortgage industries. In particular, he's been a vocal supporter of judicial foreclosure, where there is more oversight of foreclosure processes by a judge. Happy to welcome back to Current State, Curtis Hertel Jr. How are you?
Good. Thank you for having me on, Mark.
It's great to have you back. Why would you like to be the state senator in this district?
You know, for the last 5 years, I've served as Register of Deeds here in Ingham County, and we've taken a lot of tough battles. And I think we've tried to make the office more about helping people. And I see a legislature that really isn't often about helping people. I think too often they look at their own ideology their own special interest groups and don't actually look at what we can do to help people in this state. So I'm focused on trying to bring the same passion and fight that we've brought to Ingham County, suing the banks, going after bad foreclosure companies, trying to keep people in their homes, and bring that same passion to the state to fight those issues.
Refresh our memories here regarding your experience prior to becoming the County Register of Deeds. What were you doing?
For 8 years, I served on the Board of Commissioners. Really enjoyed the experience that I had there. We funded the Ingham Health Plan. We actually got to the highest level of access to care we had ever had in Ingham County, passed a living wage. So there were a lot of good things we did on the Board of Commissioners. I also served as the governor's legislative liaison for the Department of Community Health. So I worked with the legislature working on issues. I helped pass the
This is the Granholm administration.
Exactly, yes. We passed the smoke-free law, the childhood lead safety law, the childhood booster seat law, protections for seniors in nursing homes. So I have a lot of experience writing legislation, working legislation through the House and Senate, and we did that in a very bipartisan way at the time, and we got things done. I think, unfortunately, now there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of bipartisan effort, and it seems to be that we're only interested in working with our own special interest groups. So we need to go in there and be willing to work with the other side, but also say, this legislature is elected by the people and should be about the people. And I just think we've gotten way too far away from that in this state.
Are there any other Democrats you're aware of who are also interested in the seat and considering a run still?
Not right now. I mean, I think we put our first fundraiser host committee, and many of the prominent Democrats in this area have already on board our campaign. We're lucky to have a large amount of support. You know, one thing I learned from growing up in politics is you don't really worry about what other people are doing. What my job is to focus on what I want to do for people and to spend the time running our own campaign. And I think we'll do that. But I'm very excited to get out there. We're going to start knocking doors this summer. I don't like to wait on things. We want to be aggressive and get out to people and hopefully get elected in 2014.
Can you identify a few of your endorsers?
Sure. Andy Shore, Sam Singh, Tom Cochran, the sheriff, Gene Rigglesworth. Barb Byram's on the host committee.
Okay.
We have I think a lot of the prominent Democrats in this area. And we're also working to get labor union support and other Democratic institutions. But, you know, I think that we have a strong record working for people, working with organizations to actually improve this state and this county. So I think we'll get a lot of support, and I think you'll see it come early.
Have you arrived at positions on all of the hot issues at the Capitol right now, or is that a process that requires more time?
You know, I'm a student of the news, and I'm a student of politics, so I probably could talk about most issues. I mean, obviously, there needs to be more in-depth study on some issues, but I think I'm pretty good.
Let's jump into a couple of them that are really come to mind. It seems everybody's an advocate of infrastructure investment. The issue seems to be how to pay for it. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I think we certainly need better roads. Michigan is rated one of the worst roads in the country. Anybody who drives on them knows that. We certainly need to look at better funding. I want a couple priorities there. The funding can't be regressive. I think we have completely changed our tax system to benefit business and tax more on the people, and we can't do that. So we have to make sure that that's a number one priority in that process. And we also have to make sure that the work that's being done is being done by Michigan companies. In the governor's budget, they took out a provision that actually required that the first bid options were actually Michigan companies. And I think that's a huge problem. I mean, if we're going to be investing this amount of money in Michigan roads, it should be done by Michigan workers and make sure that we're investing in our own economy. It doesn't make any sense to actually bring people in from out of state to do this kind of work.
Is there any kind of it's clear there's no consensus between the Democrats and the Republicans, but is there even a consensus among the Democrats that you can pick up on? I mean, is there anything coalescing here in terms of funding transportation and infrastructure just on the Democratic side, or is it all over the road?
Well, I mean, I don't know if there's a specific plan. I mean, I know we've talked about the gas tax increase. I know we've talked about increasing the registration fee.
Right.
Those are interesting proposals. I just think we have to make sure that the way we do it is fair to middle-class Michigan citizens. I think too often we worry a lot about what corporations have done. There's a lot of loopholes in Michigan that actually protect corporations and not a lot that actually is done to protect the average citizens.
Do you support Senator Whitmer's Michigan 2020 plan as it is?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, the devil's in the details of everything and things get worked out over time. I would say that when we can close corporate investments, and this is what she's trying to do, and invest that money in education to provide access to people, it's a very good thing. You go and look at places like Kalamazoo, where they have the Promise Scholarships there, and the Kalamazoo Promise. And that has really improved kids' test scores and everything else because they know that if they do well in school, they have an actual chance to go to college. You need to give people hope at a lot of levels. So I think that it's a great plan, and I look forward to supporting it.
Last week here on Current State, Dr. Don Heller, who's the dean of the College of Education here at MSU, criticized the Michigan 2020 plan because it would allocate some college money to every Michigan high school graduate. Here's one reason why.
The main problem with the Senate Democrats' plan is that it's going to be subsidizing the college tuition of thousands and thousands of students who can well afford and their families can afford to pay that tuition. And if the Democrats can find $1.8 billion, I have lots of many better ideas of how they could spend that just related to education alone.
Does he have a point, Curtis?
Sure. I mean, I think it's a fair point that we shouldn't be subsidizing people at some income level, and there probably is a way to eventually get to a specific number. You want to make sure that people in the middle class were covered, for example. College tuition has become incredibly expensive. So the idea that a lot of people in Michigan can afford, I think, is just not true. I mean, that being said, I think the fact that we have two people talking about different ways to fund education is a good thing. I don't think we have that same thing happening on the Republican side. So, you know, yes, we might have infighting. Yes, we might have two different perspectives on exactly what the answer should be. But the answer certainly can't be, let's not fund education. So I think it's good that we have these two different perspectives. I agree that both of them are good priorities, and we just got to figure out the best way to actually make it work.
Let's say you're meeting with Governor Snyder in his office. You're senator, okay? Let's flash forward 2 years.
I'm hoping he's not governor then, but
senator.
But I understand what you're saying. Yeah,
it's all theoretical, Curtis. Let's say you're meeting with Governor Snyder, and your senator and his advisors burst in the door and they say, "Great news, Governor Snyder! It appears there's $1 million more in revenue this year than we projected." And the governor smiles and he looks at you and he says, "Senator Hertel, what do you think? What should we do with this $1 million? Any thoughts on what you would say?"
You know, $1 million is not a lot of money in state money.
So, no, it's not so much the sum; it's the priority.
No, I understand. In Ingham County, we took $60,000 in state money and actually invested it in preventing foreclosures. And for $60,000, we were able to provide for 250 people a process that actually slowed their foreclosure down and gave them due process. For a slightly smaller, more amount in terms of state money, you could expand that program for $3.5 million to the entire state. And actually give people due process in the foreclosure process.
Are you talking about judicial foreclosure here?
Actually, no. I mean, that would probably be a slightly more expensive program.
You're just talking about kind of the watchdog program.
What I'm talking about is having a legal aid attorney available to citizens that are legally foreclosed to stop those foreclosures. Every foreclosure we stop saves thousands of dollars in equity in homes in that surrounding neighborhood. For every foreclosure, each home in that neighborhood loses an average of $1,500 in value. Ingham County alone, in the last 3 years, has lost $1 billion in taxable value, largely because of the foreclosure crisis. $1 billion in taxable value. So if we can slow down just a few foreclosures, we can actually create investments in all those areas. It actually affects the way we fund schools. It affects the way we fund local government. We need to slow the foreclosures down, and if we can do that, it'll actually have a huge benefit. And also, on top of that, are providing due process to people, which should be a priority for all of us. So if we're talking about a small amount of money, I mean, obviously, I'd like to, you know, have early education programs expanded throughout the state, and obviously I'd like to provide a tuition to middle-class families so they can send their kids to college. And expand our healthcare program. But if we're talking about a small amount of money, that's one thing I think we could use it on.
You were legislative liaison for the Granholm administration. How will you respond to people who say Jennifer Granholm and a lot of Democrats had years to get it right and they just didn't get it done, and that Michigan needs reinvention just like Rick Snyder says it does?
Well, I would say two things there. First of all, you know, I don't disagree that we didn't get enough done under the Granholm administration. That being said, we had a Democratic legislature that unfortunately elected a what I would consider a Republican Speaker of the House. So we lost a lot there. You know, Andy Dillon, I'm sure he's a heck of a nice guy, but he's not exactly a progressive Democrat. So it wasn't easy to get our agenda through. Plus, we had Mike Bishop on the other side.
Who was a Republican.
So it's not really fair to say you didn't get enough done because, you know, there are a lot of roadblocks there. On the other side, this governor has had full control of the Senate and full control of the legislature. And let's look at what his actual record is. I mean, what his record has been is to side with corporations, change the tax code so that we invest in corporations and not people, and even when he's on our side, even when things like the Medicaid expansion are going on, he can't get his own party to actually vote to expand Medicaid when it's fully paid for by the federal government, would provide billions of dollars in investment in the community, would give 400,000 people access to health care, and would lower all of our premiums because they'd be getting basic care before they actually get sick, which we're already paying for now. It's a really simple equation. There's money coming in from the federal government that would provide access to care to people. On the other side, there is no reasonable argument against it. And still we can't get the legislature to do it because of ideology, mm-hmm. because of fear of Tea Party. It doesn't make any sense.
Curtis Hertel Jr. is the Ingham County Register of Deeds. He is a candidate for the state Senate's 23rd district, which includes just about all of Ingham County. Nice to visit, Curtis. We'll have you back.
I'd love to come on. Thank you.
It's Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. In his State of the State address in January, Governor Rick Snyder told lawmakers that Michigan must do better when treating people with mental health issues. The governor vowed to increase state funding for mental health, but also to work toward community-based treatment solutions. Today, a nationally known mental health advocate is speaking here in Lansing. Patrick J. Kennedy served 16 years as a Democratic congressman from Rhode Island. He's the son of the late Massachusetts Senator Edward Kennedy. In Congress, Patrick Kennedy wrote and sponsored the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act of 2008, as the name implies. The act put the reimbursement of mental health services on par with medical or surgical services. Former Congressman Patrick J. Kennedy joins me now by phone to talk about the status of mental health treatment in America. Mr. Kennedy, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me and for talking about this subject.
You're in mid-Michigan today to speak before the Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce Economic Club. You're appearing under the auspices of the HOPE Network to talk about integrating physical and mental health. First, what is the HOPE Network, and tell us about your involvement in it?
Well, the HOPE Network is a provider of mental health that's really state-of-the-art. So what we want in mental health is the same thing that we have for cancer and for diabetes, for any other physical illness. And obviously, mental health hasn't been treated the same as cancer, diabetes, or any other physical issue. We often look at mental health as a character issue, not as a chemistry issue. So we don't often treat mental health appropriately. And so what ends up happening is we treat it at the late stage. So if you compare it to cancer, we wouldn't treat someone with a mental illness or addiction until they had stage four cancer. And of course, with cancer, we would never allow that to happen. Or to make a comparison to diabetes, you know, you would be waiting till you had to amputate people's arms or legs because of diabetes. That's how long we wait to treat a mental illness and addiction. What we're trying to do and what the HOPE Network has done is try to intervene earlier in a mental illness or addiction, and frankly, they're both the same. So that is the nature of what we want in mental health. And, of course, your lieutenant governor out here was instrumental in us getting a great autism benefit, and the notion that we wouldn't treat autism like leukemia or any other childhood illness is unbelievable. But, you know, we have to fight for these things, and Brian Talley, your lieutenant governor, has done a great job in helping to do that, and I'm happy to be in Michigan to, work with both Republicans and Democrats, because, you know, this doesn't know any partisan boundaries. You know, mental illness doesn't just affect one party or another. It affects every family.
Sure.
And it's important for all of us to be in trying to do better.
Mental health parity is the law at the federal level, due in large measure to your efforts, but that's not the case state by state. Michigan, in fact, has what's called minimum mandated benefits that offer treatment for substance abuse. Why has it been so hard for mental health to achieve the same recognition as physical health?
Well, we all know that it's stigma. That means that there's a discriminatory aspect. People don't look at mental health the same way as other physical health. And then, in addition to that, there isn't any advocacy. I mean, yes, there are great organizations like National Alliance for the Mentally Ill and Mental Health America and others. But frankly, when you compare it to advocacy for other physical illnesses, you know, breast cancer, AIDS. You know, we don't have the advocacy. That's because people who have a mental illness, and I have one, I have bipolar disorder, I also have addiction. But, you know, most people don't want to tell people that they do. And furthermore, they don't want to lobby. In other words, they don't want to go up to the State House and hold up a sign saying, you know, I'm a consumer of mental health services. Because, you know, often people look down on folks who have a mental illness as if it's their fault.
Just yesterday, your former colleague in Congress, Michigan Senator Debbie Stabenow, led a forum on this topic. She was talking with service providers who work in community mental health centers, which are structurally different from what are called federally qualified health centers. She said that a bill she's currently sponsoring called the Excellence in Mental Health Act would close the gap between these two systems in terms of how they're reimbursed or for providing mental health services. Here she is.
So our bill would simply say that if you meet a higher level of quality services, and we lay out what that is, including providing a 24-hour emergency response, that you would be able to bill Medicaid at the same level that health centers do. And so this is the final mental health parity piece.
Do you have a take on the Excellence in Mental Health Act then?
Yeah, I think, first of all, Debbie Stabenow, Senator Stabenow, has been a champion of mental health in Congress, and Michigan really has great political leadership. I just really salute her. She was instrumental in having mental health parity get integrated into the Affordable Care Act. And now she continues the charge. You know what? Veterans, Michigan has, I think, number one in the country for the amount of time that your National Guard and Reserve served in Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, everyone knows that the signature wound of the war is traumatic brain injury and post-traumatic stress. And all of these veterans work for every employer in the state of Michigan. And often they won't go to the VA, especially if you can't see their injury from the outside. So I think it's incumbent upon all people across this country to try to make sure mental health is provided, because keep in mind, our veterans are going to need the kind of care for their brain, since the fact that their brain was really affected by this war, either through this traumatic brain injury, as I said, or it's the stress of the post-traumatic stress. These things change the brain, and yet we still call it the invisible wound of war. But there's nothing invisible about the trauma that our veterans suffered while serving our country and protecting all of us from another terrorist attack.
We're talking with former U.S. Congressman Patrick J. Kennedy, mental health advocate, who is in Lansing here today. Another bill Senator Stabenow's co-sponsoring is the Mental Health First Aid Act. It's designed to help the public identify and respond to signs of mental illness and addiction disorders. Has there ever been anything like that type of training program in the United States that you're aware of?
No, there has not been. And I salute her for doing this. Mental health first aid has already been implemented in many other countries around the world, particularly Australia really pioneered it. It's ready for the United States, and we should have it. And what it basically is like CPR. Now, if someone, you know, fell over on the side of the road, you know, and they needed CPR, we have CPR training. If you go to the beach and you want to, in Lake Michigan, you want to get, you know, make sure you have a lifeguard, you have someone who knows CPR. We need to have CPR for mental health. And that's what mental health first aid is. It's recognizing when our friends and families and neighbors have a mental health issue, and it's knowing what to do. Right now, people often turn the other way because they don't feel comfortable talking to someone who's clearly suffering from some kind of mental illness. And we need to change that in this country.
Mental health advocate Patrick J. Kennedy, the former congressman, U.S. congressman from Rhode Island, and mental health advocate in Lansing today. Patrick Kennedy, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
It's WKAR's Current State. Lansing Mayor Virge Bernero has formally presented his proposed 2014 budget to the City Council. The much-anticipated proposal comes just days after an independent review team, appointed by the mayor, issued an ambitious set of recommendations to shore up Lansing's long-term financial standing. Current State's Kevin Lavery attended last night's City Council meeting and files this report.
Bernero is proposing a $112 million budget for fiscal year 2014. It's a figure he says is less than what former Mayor David Hollister operated under 10 years ago. Mayor Bernero says he's confident the plan will put the city on a path toward long-term stability.
I believe this budget is balanced, it's prudent, it's fair. We're not asking for taxpayers to suffer at the workers' expense or workers to suffer at taxpayers' expense. This is a win-win budget.
One of the key features is an annual $46 utility charge that would be billed to each residential customer of the Lansing Board of Water and Light to pay for the operation of fire hydrants and streetlights. Bernero says for many customers, that fee would be offset with an average $45 property tax cut. The city's projected budget deficit had been estimated at around $9 million. But the mayor says recent adjustments calculated in the last few days indicate that total may end up being as low as $5 million. Such big savings, though, are largely dependent on whether Lansing's police union is willing to make concessions to pay more for their health care. That would require renegotiating their existing contract, a move the union has been unwilling to make. But Bernero is calling for shared sacrifice.
Everybody's ox is being gored. It's not a matter where we're trying to take it out on any one person. We're all going to sacrifice. My health care plan will change. So I'm not asking them to do anything that I'm not doing. But to sit it out and bury your head in the sand and say, well, we've got a contract and we're not, until such time, we're not going to do it. You know, these things are coming to you and to your members. So why not come and be a part of the solution instead of being part of the problem?
But Councilmember Jody Washington believes the city needs to think of an alternative funding source if the police union refuses to yield.
They certainly have the right to not open their contract. What was negotiated in good faith. So if they choose not to open their contract, I'm supportive of that, and we'll have to look for alternative funding.
With a draft on the table, the negotiation process begins. The Lansing City Council has until May 20th to adopt a final budget that will take effect July 1st. For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
And joining us now to go a little deeper into the administration's proposal, Lansing City Council President Carol Wood, nice to see you.
It's nice to see you.
Let's start with the big picture here. The mayor wants, or the big piece, I should say, the mayor wants BWL customers to pay $46 more per year for streetlights and fire hydrants. Now that, according to his framework, would close the $5 million budget gap for 2014. What do you think?
Well, when you look at the fact that this is a public utility and our rates have attracted businesses as well as residential customers into our community, adding this on is no different than a rate hike. And that also, we have been for a number of years 5 to 10% less than what some of the utilities in and around us would be. Will this make a difference with businesses and residents deciding to stay here? One of the things that we need to look at is, and I call it a tipping point, when do the charges for services become more than what people are willing to pay? We have the Board of Water and Light, again, as a public utility. When we look at the fact that the people coming into our city every single day are utilizing those same streetlights, are utilizing the water if there are fire, it should be a shared situation and not just on the backs of the residents.
But according to the administration, they maintain that this $46 additional charge is essentially compensated for, if I understand it correctly, and correct me if I'm wrong, but these are falling property tax rates, correct?
There have been falling property tax rates, but the public also voted for a 4% mill increase that are going to police and fire and roads. And along with that, one of the things that we've seen is a decline in income taxes. So I might not, I might be seeing a decrease in my property tax, but I'm also seeing a decrease in my paycheck that's coming home every week. So when you're looking at this, that offset is not there. Along with the fact that when when we're looking at some of the increases in fees that are in this budget. It's an increase with recycling, with waste, a number of those things. So that savings that I might be getting in property tax is being eaten up in other fees that are presented in this particular budget.
Can you help us understand how this debate over public safety cutting, and again, the financial health team is recommending $3 million in cuts total to both the Lansing Fire Department and the Lansing Police Department. Is that debate related to the Board of Water and Light recommendation? Do those pieces of this thing interact in some way?
A little within the fire department. The fire department is charged for the hydrant rental that we have as part of their budget. But I think you also have to understand these numbers keep floating around out there, from the fact that we've had the financial health team talking about a $12 million deficit, to the fact that last night Mayor Bonero did present a balanced budget, but it was dealing with a $5 million deficit. Trying to get our arms around from a council perspective of what the true deficit is and what we're looking at is going to be a challenge for us. And when you look again that the health team had been looking at some of these numbers for the last 6 months, and within days we have those numbers changing again, I'm not sure what will be on the table by the time we actually sit down and start talking about
it. When did you learn the deficit would be $5 million as opposed to $9 million?
Yesterday.
Yesterday during the day? Prior to the...
Just a few minutes before the meeting, yes.
Okay. What are we to make of that?
I mean, that's the interesting part of it. What are we to make of it?
The figure does move around. I mean, they're constantly updating revenue projections, et cetera.
Absolutely.
Property values.
The figure does continue to move around. But again, there are measures in this budget that the mayor is looking at, which is adding to the deficit. He's talking about our information technology and spending $2 million on that. He's talking about adding a cabinet position, which would be additional salaries. I think when you see these moving targets, and then you're talking about the fact that you might have to reduce and not have community police officers, I'm not sure that people want to see an information technology department head versus having an officer on the street in their neighborhood.
Is it your understanding that Mayor Bernero supports the financial health team's recommendation of $2 million in cuts to fire and $1 million to police?
And that's unclear at this particular time. Again, part of it, what we've got is his initial layout of his plan. We've not seen the line item detail. What we've heard are there are some cuts that he's expecting from the police and fire department, the police department with their health care. Whether that equates to $1.7 million, we've yet to see what those figures are.
So we didn't learn last night what cuts to public safety the mayor might propose?
No.
It didn't go that deep?
No, it didn't go that deep last night. Okay. And again, what we received last night was a layout of the different departments based on salary and operating expenses, and we received it at 7 o'clock, and I'm here at 9:30 doing the interview, so I've not had an opportunity to read through it page by page yet.
How long before we find out where the administration stands on cuts to public safety?
I think we'll see that as we start the budget process, and we will be holding budget hearings every Monday night, and they start at 5:30. They go to 7 until we have our council meeting. We have a short council meeting, and then we go back into budget hearings approximately 8:30, 9 o'clock at night, and go to 10 or 11, depending on the department that's in and how rigorous the questioning is.
Dave Hollister says the public safety unions need to give more, and this is a common part of the narrative here now. They just have it. There hasn't been mutually shared sacrifice. We had Dave Hollister on this show a week ago saying they haven't given anything. What do you make of that?
Well, and in talking to some of the people within the union, I've been told that they just negotiated some changes in their health care that would save the city approximately $450,000. So, you know, I think it's who takes credit for what and whether you believe they've given enough or not enough. One of the arguments that council has been making for some time, and I myself have talked about the fact that we're renting a precinct. We had gone from two precincts down to one, but when you look at what it's costing us to rent that building with utilities and janitorial services, we're talking at roughly $400,000 a year. We had the health financial team say that we need to sell City Hall because it isn't being utilized to its fullest extent. Let's move the police department back into City Hall. That would save $400,000 right there, and it could happen tomorrow.
We have under a minute, Carol. You've run for mayor. You think like an executive in many respects, I think. Is it fair to ask you how you would propose closing a $5 million budget gap?
Well, I think we go back to what the council said a year ago. And one of the things that we had asked was that the Board of Water and Light payment in lieu of taxes be increased by 0.5%. And that would close the gap that we have today.
That's $5 million.
That would be $5 million.
Right there. And where do we stand on the GM piece? Is that going to hearings as well?
Yes, and that's extremely important as we look at the bottom line and bringing jobs and revenues into the city of Lansing.
Very good. Carol Wood is the president of the Lansing City Council. Thanks for coming in, Carol.
Thank you.
Last Tuesday, Current State started our weekly conversations on environmental issues facing the Great Lakes Basin. The segments are part of a partnership between Current State and MSU's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. And here to discuss the collaboration is David Paulson. Paulson is the Associate Director of the Knight Center for Environmental Journalism, and he's also the editor of the online environmental news magazine, Great Lakes Echo. Hi, Dave. How are you?
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me here.
Tell our listeners who are unaware of the Knight Center about the Knight Center for Environmental Journalism.
Well, the center is a unit of the School of Journalism. We've been around about 18 years, and we like to think that we're the longest and the best program for training journalists to cover complex environmental issues. Translating them for the public.
In the country.
In the country, absolutely. And so we have undergraduate program, we have a graduate program, we do a significant amount of outreach to professional journalists and helping them tell the environmental story.
You're editor of the Great Lakes Echo. What does the Great Lakes Echo cover? Give us some examples.
Well, we do a lot of straight-up news, the type of thing that that people might be real familiar with in terms of environmental issues, pollution, wetland restoration, wetland destruction, climate change, energy. But we also like to have a little bit of fun, too. Try to get a little creative in terms of reaching our public. Last week, we had a story about the impact of the new Pope on Great Lakes policy. And the idea isn't...
Huh.
Well, the idea...
That's an angle I would not have thought of real quickly.
Well,
tell us about that.
Well, there's not a Great Lakes office in the Vatican, but we are... a religion is a very fascinating source of environmental inspiration and, interestingly, a source of environmental communication, and it's a way of getting... of reaching a certain segment of the public on environmental issues.
Very interesting. Who produces your content, then?
Well, we have a variety of sources. Students produce our content, both graduate and undergraduate students. We have a paid staff. We hire professional freelancers. Some of them are alums of our program. From time to time, they contribute to it. faculty contribute to it. And in kind of an exciting development this year, we've begun to partner with other journalism schools throughout the Great Lakes Basin. So, for instance, the University of Minnesota's School of Journalism in Duluth has produced several real fascinating looks at Lake Superior for us. Kent State University has produced some kind of mini documentaries on farming and mining and other things as well.
And for our listeners who are sitting there thinking, why spend all of this energy just on reporting about the environment? Why this emphasis? Make your case for a particular focus on reporting environmental news.
Well, there's a lot of real important stories out there, but we would make the argument that nothing trumps the fate of the planet, that everything is based all these very complex political and other issues have their roots in resource issues, in environmental issues. And it's some of these are very, very complex, and so it's kind of incumbent upon the journalists to explain that complexity to the public. That's why we're real excited about this partnership here with Current State. You guys tackle some really good issues that everybody's interested in, and we think the environment should be front and center in those issues that get discussed.
We're excited about it, too. That's David Poulsen. He's Associate Director of the Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. He's also the editor of Great Lakes Echo, where there are a wide range of stories covering the Great Lakes, and you can hear Current State's environmental segment every Tuesday, including this Tuesday. Thanks very much, Dave.
Thanks, Mark.
It's been 100 years since the International Joint Commission conducted a Great Lakes-wide bacteriological study. Scientists are now looking to recreate the 1913 study. The 100-year study will assess how water quality in the Great Lakes Basin has changed over time. Lead researcher Dr. Joan Rose is the Nowlan Center Chair of Water Research, co-director of the Center for Water Sciences, and co-director of the Center for Advancing Microbial Risk Assessment here at Michigan State. Dr. Rose said they started the study in 1913 because people were getting sick.
During that time, they were having a lot of typhoid outbreaks, and drinking water was the problem. So people were drinking the water, the wastewater was going into our water supply, and people were getting sick. And in fact, some of the largest outbreaks occurred in Detroit and Chicago, and people were getting sick and dying. And in the early 1900s, Canada and the U.S. recognized the value of the Great Lakes, and they created an agreement to manage the Great Lakes together. And one of the first things they realized was that there was this great, you know, layer of pollution, you know. And so they did this study using the most advanced microbiological techniques of the time to look at the fecal pollution around the Great Lakes. It was spread completely across the whole region. And it's still today, 100 years later, one of the largest studies ever done on a large water basin.
Hmm. Now, the new study you're looking to do is, in a sense, is to recreate this 1913 study. Is it fair to ask what you're expecting to find?
You know, we get asked all the time, has the water gotten better or worse?
Sure.
What's the water quality like? And so many things have changed. Our instinct is to say, for sure, the water has gotten better. We're smarter. We're treating our wastewater. Now we have the Clean Water Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act. But then we start to think about it a little bit more. There's more people. There's more animals. There's more waste going into our system. There's more combined sewer overflows. Climate has changed. We certainly know that in the last 20 years, we're getting greater precipitation, which leads to more stormwater. We've lost wetlands. So there's so many things that have changed, and we really haven't looked at this historical perspective over this long time to answer that simple question. Has our water quality gotten better or worse in the Great Lakes in regard to fecal pollution?
And you hope this study will once and for all answer that question.
We think that this study will help us answer that. And we'd like to, there's you know, the resources in the Great Lakes, it's not just the water resources, it's the intellectual resources. Both on the Canada and the U.S. side, there's so many great scientists that have been studying this system. And we have a lot of data. In fact, right in Lake Sinclair, we looked at data from the 1940s all the way to current time where they'd been monitoring their water quality. And we took it out of old notebooks that had been handwritten. And it was amazing, you know, the amount of data that's out there. So we think that there's data out there to be mined that we can analyze. And we also think that in the last 5 years, the new techniques are giving us new insight into pollution, not just how much pollution is there, but where is it coming from? Because that's the second question that we've always been asking and never been able to answer.
Now, are you referring to technology creating pollution, or are you talking about technology detecting pollution,
yeah,
or both?
I'm talking about both, but in this regard, I'm talking about the new technology that allows us to test water. And when we take a sample, we're able to identify the source of the fecal pollution. This is called microbial source tracking. And it's sort of the CSI of water, we like to call it, you know, the CSI of water. And we use some of the same techniques that you see on television shows and in the courtroom. We actually look at the DNA of bacteria in water. And we can tell whether it's come from sewage in humans or whether it's come from birds.
How about that? So fecal pollution is still a focus of the current study?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
It's very interesting. In 1913, of course, they were very worried about drinking water and people, getting quite ill. And in today, 100 years later, we've seen a shift, and partly because of engineering technology in treating our drinking water, but we've seen this shift from worrying so much about drinking water, we've done a very good job there, to worrying about our beaches, our coastline, our ecosystems, and the economics, you know, that coastline provides, both from fishing and tourism, all kinds of things. So we've seen a shift, and there's certainly what appears to be in the record an increasing threat of fecal pollution to our shoreline.
Who's working on the study?
We have a very large group very interested in this study. We have about 20 core people that are coalescing together, and they represent scientists from NOAA, the Great Lakes Environmental Research Lab, from the USGS. They represent scientists at health departments and state agencies, as well as private laboratories and academic scientists like myself. And so we have a very large group representing almost every state in the U.S. That border the Great Lakes and on the Canada side as well.
There's a lot of different work being done in the Great Lakes, and a lot of those studies take a lake-by-lake approach. This study you're embarking on is basin-wide. Why look basin-wide, and what might we learn that we wouldn't studying lake-by-lake?
When you start to look at time and space, changes over time and space, we get a better sense of our lessons learned on what we should do right. There are some site-specific issues that we need to address. But what's interesting, if you look at these maps, this is the original GIS in 1913, hand-drawn maps of the pollution, and you look at those and you overlay them with today's areas of concern, they are very, very similar. And so we know where these hotspots are. What we don't know about these hotspots is, are they similar in terms of sources of pollution, health risk, and management strategies to control that pollution?
Looking globally, the Great Lakes are the largest group of freshwater lakes on Earth. The Great Lakes must have an impact globally as well. Am I right?
Yeah. You know, when you look at all the international basins around the world, and there's something like 260-some water systems that are shared by more than one country, and in some cases, three, four, five countries. The Great Lakes is still, Canada and the U.S. still has the best agreement around water quality. And when you think about it, you know, quantity, when we think about quantity, a glass of water, how much water's flowing in that stream, how much rain falls, how much stormwater, et cetera, we can get our arms you know, around quantity. But quality is very complex. It's what contaminants, where are they coming from? Do they cause us harm? How do we get rid of them? Are there new contaminants? So these are, it's so complex. And the Great Lakes has a water quality agreement that is a model for all over the world. And water quality equals health. There's no doubt about it. Equals health for humans, equals health for animals and our wildlife, our ecosystem, and our economics. So water quality is health. And we need to get our arms around that. And I think the Great Lakes Agreement, the studies that have gone on in the past, and the new work that's going to happen in the Great Lakes is really a model globally for the big basins, the Ganges River in India, you know, the Yangtze in China, you know, and we can go on and on. There's just such so much need for good science to address water quality and health in the future.
Has it been a long time since a lot of those global water systems have been studied, just like in the Great Lakes? Has it been decades or years?
Yes, and in many cases, it's so piecemeal in the rest of the world in terms of studying water quality that you really can't even find a map of water quality globally around fecal pollution. You can find some maps on arsenic and fluoride, some of the groundwater pollutants that are naturally occurring because they're part of the geological formation. But if you try to find a good global map on water quality, you cannot find one. And some of these very important systems, I mean, the World Bank is going to fund a lot of money for restoration of the Ganges. Look at what we've been doing in the Great Lakes in terms of restoration, protection, and addressing future concerns. This is a global model. There's no doubt about it.
Dr. Joan Rose is the Nolan Endowed Chair of Water Research, co-director of the Center for Water Sciences, and co-director of the Center for Advancing Microbial Risk Assessment at Michigan State University. She is the lead researcher on the 100-year study, which is reevaluating water quality in the Great Lakes a century after the International Joint Commission 1913 project. Dr. Rose, thanks very much.
Well, thanks for having me.
And coming up Wednesday here on Current State, Right to Work is about to take effect. We'll discuss it. And for our Neighbors in Action segment, we'll learn about the Reach Studio Art Center in Lansing. That and more tomorrow here on Current State. The executive producer of our show is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is the Current State producer. Thanks to Aaron Young for engineering, Gabriella Saldivia and Sonia Treeweiler for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.